This is not normal. Since 2016, the UK has been in a crisis of its own making. But it's not the fault of Brexit, but of a larger problem of our politics. Here to explain why it's not normal is William Davis, author of the book. William, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. You've written, the book is a series of articles and essays that you've written over the past couple of years about the situation, the peculiar situation that the UK finds itself in. Why is it not normal, as you say?
Well, I think what has become clear over the last 4 years, and I think the Brexit referendum was obviously what kind of unleashed this, was that there's a large section both of our political elite, but also perhaps of the electorate as well, that no longer wants to play politics via the traditional games of the institutions that have really held politics and democracy together, including much of the mainstream media, which is treated with great suspicion. And the book is partly about the sort of huge loss of trust in those mainstream institutions of politics, of the independent institutions of government, and also of the media. Those are the kind of key areas where I think that there's been this, I suppose, a crisis of elite, which has led people to want to kind of overthrow normality to some extent.
I mean, you describe it as the collapse of liberal Britain. Do you think that we are becoming more polarised and more perhaps extreme, you know, tossing out the what was basically the public norms from before?
I think that is what's happening. I think that there is clearly a move towards what might be called populism, and has been witnessed around the world, but I think has its own particular version in Britain. But I think that the central problem that we're witnessing is that institutions that used to be seen as the kind of, I suppose, the space in which politics happens, they used to be seen as being neutral to some extent, are now seen as being biased. So in the context of Brexit, you see this notion widely propagated by Brexiteers that, you know, that institutions of the government or the central bank, the Bank of England, or the BBC and so on, are kind of anti-Brexit. And that in that sense, people are kind of politicizing and unleashing these so-called culture wars in areas of public life that previously were seen as being, if not entirely neutral on questions of what is the best policy, at least being outside of the space of party politics. And at the moment, we're witnessing a government that, being led by the likes of Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson, is trying to really kind of not completely sort of tear up the rules of Whitehall and the bureaucracy of government, but to unleash a whole new different way of doing things on the basis that the traditional norms that you mentioned are self-serving and really only representing their own cultural tribe.
I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you're not just looking at, you know, the vote, the referendum, but there's also a couple of other cultural things that come in, news events, if you like. You have Windrush and you have Grenfell Tower, and those perhaps have a bigger impact on what's happening at the moment than you might think at first glance.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that, I mean, so these events have also had their effects on the left, their manifestation on the left. I mean, the period that the book covers, which is the from 2016 through to the end of 2019, and so really kind of only just grasps what the even less normal events that have followed. I mean, I discussed that towards the end of the book with the pandemic of the last 6 months. But I think that we also witnessed some really kind of very feverish and anti-establishment political forces on the left around Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, the entirely unexpected electoral result of the summer of 2017, where Corbyn forced a hung parliament, and really very few people saw that coming. But, you know, as I discuss in the book, around that time, you also had, straight after that election, you had the Grenfell Tower catastrophe that you mentioned, and then the following spring you had the kind of public unveiling of this Windrush tragedy that had been unfolding over several years. And I think what those events meant for people, I mean, in ways that I think sort of in some ways parts of the left and the right shared parts of this, I think, was that a kind of technocratic liberalism that had been so powerful under the Blair years of the late 1990s and early 2000s, and which really said that, well, the key issues of politics are kind of beyond party politics. They're beyond division. We can have consensus on the right way to run our economy and the right way to deliver policies. It turned out that actually some of that consensus was actually the basis of some quite kind of punitive and had some quite disastrous outcomes. And I think that people have lost faith in a kind of rationalist, technocratic vision of liberalism, and they've lost faith not just on the right, because they, you know, who might argue that, well, it doesn't take enough count of nation or and of tradition, but also on the left, on the sense that this vision of the center ground actually was really kind of oblivious to some of the harms that it was doing to people's lives on a day-to-day basis.
I mean, this is perhaps one of the things, isn't it? Something like Grenfell, the groundswell of public opinion and Windrush is that we are being governed by an elite that doesn't seem to care.
That I think has become the dominant suspicion and feeling of our times. And I mean, one of the pieces in the book is about the specific loss of trust of elites, which. I mean, I'm quite interested in what's happened to trust over recent years. And one of the things which I think is very striking is that trust in scientists and trust in things like independent statisticians and so on has actually not fallen drastically. But trust in journalists and professional politicians has really kind of fallen very steadily over the last 40 years in Britain. I think that what that means is that people, when they look at what the events in public life and what is being discussed in the public sphere, they've come to see that, for understandable reasons, as being a bit of a sham much of the time. And one of the things that I talk about in the chapter on, or the essay on elites and trust, is that actually, if you look at what happened in Britain from the financial crisis of 2008 onwards, for the following decade, every year there was a kind of major crisis or a major scandal that was really rocked our assumptions to the core. I mean, you had the hacking scandal that surrounded News International and engulfed Downing Street in 2011. You had things like the scandal surrounding Jimmy Savile that engulfed the BBC. You had the MP's expenses scandal of 2009. You had each year there was another one of these sort of discoveries that actually institutions that people had really taken for granted as being sort of upholding the public interest and have perhaps maybe been sort of sometimes naively supportive of, and in some sense cast as a leap of faith, was exposed in a really quite sort of dramatic and sometimes extremely upsetting way, and in ways that maybe it's very difficult to restore some of that trust. I mean, I would argue something like the MP's expenses scandal did really kind of huge damage to the way in which Parliament was perceived, and this idea that actually they're all crooks and they're all in it for themselves, I think was a very, very powerful force in the kind of anti-political or anti-parliament politics that we then saw around, first of all, the Brexit referendum, and then the kind of the fallout of the Brexit referendum, which obviously took another 3.5 years until you got to the Johnson election of December 2019.
And of course, there's been a titanic shift in the way that we consume or we get our information now, because of 10 years, 15 years ago, there wasn't the power of social media and that information that you have now.
That's right. So, I mean, for starters, I think that in the past, if somebody was to be watching the news, go back only 15 years, you watch the news and there's politicians on and there's political commentators on and so on. You might say, I don't like this guy very much, or I don't think that person's speaking, I'm not sure about them, I don't like their face, whatever it might be. Nowadays, of course, you can go into Facebook, you can go onto YouTube, you can go onto Twitter and so on, and you can actually find that there are a lot of people who think exactly the same as you, and that actually these people are thinking, and that you can find out that you can also find out a lot more about a particular pundit or commentator or politician. You could find out, I mean, it's a little bit like how the MP's expenses scandal worked, I think, which had a very important cultural dimension, which was that you can find out where people buy their curtains, and you can find out what people sort of more sort of personal views are. That's what social media has done to institutions such as the BBC, is so that you can start to get a more rounded, more cultural, more intimate view of a particular pundit. And of course, that then creates divisions. You think, well, actually, this person's got, I've got nothing in common with this person. But I think the other thing, which is, you know, what's happened as a result of digital technologies in our society and with profound implications for how democracy works and how truth itself works, is that I think increasingly, if you think of the scandals I mentioned earlier, often these discoveries came to light through things like email trails. And there's a sense that actually the truth is now to be sort of found via whistleblowers, via the sort of leaking from these kind of huge data archives. And actually, you know, that what happens in the kind of public record of the newspapers and things like Hansard in Parliament is really less significant to what's really going on in society compared to the kind of huge sort of big data banks that we're kind of leaving behind us every time we use technologies and so on. And I think there is a kind of a sort of normalization of the kind of paranoid mindset of the conspiracy theorist, which has we're seeing being ramped up even further in the context of this pandemic, but which is that, you know, we increasingly look at the public statements of politicians and so on. And I mean, maybe we've always been a bit cynical about politicians, but increasingly I think what we see in the media, what we see in the public performances and statements of politics are seen rather more as a sort of theatre, rather more as kind of the putting on of masks and the putting on of performances. Meanwhile, the real information, the real facts are kind of going on somewhere behind the scenes and are sort of stored somewhere either, you know, and we might find out if there's a whistleblower, but otherwise we're probably never going to really find out the truth of what's going on.
You've also, and this sort of raised my eyebrows because it's something that I'm quite interested in, is the dying of empire. And even though, you know, the British Empire has, you can say it was going in the 30s, but it was definitely over by 45, it still has an effect. It still has sort of, the ripples are still affecting 21st century life in the UK.
Well, I think, I mean, there's the UK is having another series of reflections about its identity in the world. I think this is something that I think that the initial period where the development of what it's almost called Powellism after Enoch Powell in the 1960s, of a sort of, you know, where do we stand in relation to our former colonies and what is our status in the world once we no longer exist as a world power. That sort of period of self-reflection kind of took hold from the 1950s through to the 1970s. And there's been various forces, mainly on the right, which have sort of tried to kind of reassert Britain's status as a world power, with, you know, led by the likes of Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. But I think that right now there is, I suppose, a sort of renewed kind of grief, really, for the fact that Britain's status is kind of, you know, what does Britain's scale in the world, which is being sort of reasserted by some of these Brexiteers, although, I mean, not, I think, always in the most kind of sort of, so obviously, not, I don't think in the most credible way, but also perhaps not always in a way that is meant entirely seriously. It's often primarily in a kind of symbolic way that Britain is a place that can kind of, you know, can turn to its past and kind of resuscitate certain things. But it's I think, you know, there are obviously still huge questions as to what kind of economic status Britain has in the future outside of such a large trading bloc as it's just left.
So where do you think we go now then? If liberal Britain has collapsed, and that is an idea of the 50s and 60s and 70s that is now has no relevance to modern living, if you had to have a crystal ball or get your telescope out, where do you think we're going with this one?
Well, I think that politics will continue to be pretty polarized. I don't see any way out of that. I think that there's it's very difficult to know how to deal with the fact that when a very large section of society comes to view institutions and as self-serving and no longer serving the public interest, that's obviously a huge opportunity for a politician who comes along, whether that will be the politicians of a mainstream party such as the Conservatives or a more fringe party. And I think we will see this kind of constant setting up of fringe movements, fringe parties. It's very easy to get a kind of fringe movement going today, or at least compared to how it used to be. And I think we will see sort of constant sort of, you know, sometimes just sort of threats, really, of, oh, well, you know, that we, if you don't listen to these people, we're going to set up a new, you know, a new media entity, a new political party, a new kind of cultural political movement. So I think we will see this kind of constant ebbing and flowing of new sort of fringe movements to making demands that the mainstream parties either accommodate in the way that sort of the Conservatives accommodated aspects of UKIP, or sort of in some ways have to kind of deal with and sort of somehow coexist with. So I think that's going to be a fairly constant phenomenon. I suppose the question is whether what's happening on the centre-left and the left is that the notion of what it means to be representative is changing. So in the sense that in the past, the judiciary could seek to be representative by the virtue of the fact that they're kind of outside of politics and that they sort of, you know, subscribe to certain principles and they, you know, they're fully trained lawyers and so on. Increasingly, I think there is going to be a demand that institutions, and this was being discussed only this morning about the Supreme Court, that they seem more culturally representative in terms of ethnicity and in terms of identity and in terms of their different backgrounds. And I think the question, I suppose, is can institutions such as the BBC and institutions of government, whether they can ever adequately satisfy that demand for a type of cultural representation rather than as a type of their current sort of ideal of representation. That's, I think, the big question. And then to what extent can that then be sort of that game be kind of subverted and weaponized by the right by saying, oh, well, you're not representative in the way that we believe. So there are going to be these kind of constant wars over the extent to which institutions actually are representative. And I think in some ways these are sort of distraction, or not distraction, but these things can often drag in more attention from some of the kind of more serious sort of policy issues that are often going on at the same time to do with, you know, most urgently at the moment with the pandemic. So I think that we will see more of the same, but I can't say exactly where this is all going to be in 10 years' time.
Well, we'll probably look forward to This Is Not Normal 2 in 10 years' time.
This is still not normal.
It's still not normal. This one is called, that was called This Is Not Normal. It's out now. It's Verso Books. It's available on...
That's right.
If people want to find you online, I know you have an online presence on Twitter. Where can they find you, please?
I'm at Davis_Will.
The book is called This Is Not Normal, The Collapse of Liberal Britain. It's by William Davis. Will, thank you so much for your time today.
Great. It's been a pleasure.